Good evening, everyone. You've tuned in to Paradigm Shifters, and we have a wonderful paradigm shifter here. And by popular request, we have her back for our second discussion of the Tibetan psychology and their philosophy and understanding and even the practice of dying. Rachel Van Dessel is one who teaches a lot about Tibetan spirituality and philosophy and psychology, but also how to bring in the Tibetan deities in dance, and also does Qigong. But today, Rachel, I think we're going to push the whole subject of death and the Tibetan way of thinking and perceiving all that. So welcome to the show for the second time. I'm so grateful you're here.
Thank you so much, Veronica. I really appreciate coming back to talk more in depth about the process of dying.
Well, I just want you to know it's popular request. People really want this information. So, and you mentioned last time about, we'll go right to the POWA. Do you want to tell people what that means, P-H-O-W-A?
Yes, POWA is a Tibetan practice for dying. And they call it a death insurance or assurance. And it's a way of really dying professionally so that you know what you're doing. You recognize the stages of death and you actually have a practice you can do to send your consciousness into the clearest, lightest, most beneficial space possible as you progress from life to life.
So
that's the basis of POWA.
And can anyone learn it? I mean, is it like a many, many years of Tibetan practice, Tibetan meditation, and so on?
No, absolutely not. You can learn it whether you're a Buddhist or not. You don't have to be a big meditator. Of course, it helps to meditate because part of the process is clearing the mind and being open to the moment. And meditation is all about that kind of mind training. But anyone can go and take a POWA teaching. And Ayin Rinpoche has been sent around the world, as I said last time, by the Dalai Lama to teach POWA because he's such an amazing teacher. And I hear he's going to do one in Vancouver, not sure when.
Yeah, we don't know when, but because of your discussion last time, I kind of Googled it and found out what was going on in Vancouver, and they said he was definitely coming. Isn't that exciting? I want to go
That's
learn.
That's so exciting. Yes. So yes, what, and I hope you take all your friends with you.
So far, I have a little group of them ready to go.
Fantastic.
Yeah, and when you're telling us about the POWA, does that mean it's like, I know you do Qigong and so on, is it like moving an energy? Is it like...
Yes. So maybe I'll go into the process of death so we can talk about exactly what's going on from the Tibetan Buddhist point of view only. It's not it's not to say any other person's experience or understanding is wrong at all. This is just from the Tibetan point of view.
Okay, now just let me ask you this one question. Is this ancient? Is this a very, very old system?
Yes, it's an old system. Okay. Definitely an old system.
Great.
And, you know, many high lamas and just normal practitioners have achieved very high states and even enlightenment through this process.
Wow. All right. Well, let's learn it together.
All right. And they say even small insects have an opportunity to realize the clear light of death during the death process because it's such a powerful transition.
Wow. Well, what's the clear light mean?
Clear light of death means it has to do with enlightenment, that you actually perceive the luminous, spacious, vast quality of the living universe in your own being.
Wow. I mean, that's wonderful, huh?
Yeah. It's really exciting. I think this is so exciting. And of course, we can help other people by knowing what's going on while they're dying and being there and helping them with their fear and going through the death process with them. There isn't, in my opinion, there's nothing more beneficial, satisfying, and wonderful than being able to do that for each other.
And what if somebody's in a state of trauma and can't focus?
Right. Well, then we can be there to help them calm down, to help, to alleviate their fear, to purify the air around them, to bring happiness and light as much as we possibly can to their situation. That would even be in an accident on the freeway when someone dies. You know, so many people are sitting there upset because they're late, because they didn't get home or get to their appointment, whatever. Mm-hmm. But if we can bring that light and that joy to that person who's going through that experience, because the mind gets so sensitive during this process, it picks up on all the energies and thought forms around. So it's very important how we approach people who are going through this transition.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Is it a rapid transition, or is it, what I mean is, does it hasten the process of leaving the body, or can it?
POA itself, it can very much be rapid, and you can do it, you know, if while you still have strength, when you know absolutely you're going to die maybe in a week or something and you're losing strength, you can actually start to do POA then. Hmm. And POA is a way of bringing the energies into the center channel, into the heart center, and then bringing it up through out through the crown aperture into a very clear place, the Buddha's heart or a Pure Land or any kind of open, light place that you can imagine. So it's a way of doing that. And so as we start to die and the breathing gets slower and slower, there are these different
phases.
Phases mm-hmm. you pass through on your way from this life into the intermediate state called the bardos,
okay,
and then on into the next life. And so the first element to dissolve is the earth element. Okay. And you can tell that because you'll have a sinking feeling. As the earth element dissolves, you'll feel like you're sinking down, maybe down into the earth. And you're no longer mindful of your feelings. You lose the sense of your limbs, and you feel a sinking. So the aggregate of form begins to dissolve.
Okay.
So that's the first thing that happens as you begin to die. And then the second phase is the water element, or the fluid element, begins to dry up. So the blood and the lymph and all the many fluids in the body, interstitial fluids, begin to dry up, and you'll have a sense or a vision even of smoke. And that's the second phase of dissolving.
Hmm.
And the third phase, so we're going through all the elements here on Earth. So you have Earth is the first one, water is the second one, fire is the third one. And you'll see like a sputtering candle about to go out. You'll feel like you can't taste anything anymore. So these are, you know, have been somehow documented as phases that one passes through as you go through the death process.
Hmm.
The fourth one is the wind element, and it has to do with discrimination. And you'll see sparks flying as the wind element goes.
That's kind of interesting, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And it's discriminating what? Is it like choosing your thoughts or choosing, is it discriminating that way?
No, it's just that aggregate of discrimination begins to dissolve.
Uh-huh.
So you are no longer in a place where you have the ability to use these functions. They start to dissolve one by one. So you're going inner to more subtle and subtle phases and also abilities. So, you know, you lose the ability to taste, feel your limbs. You lose the ability to discriminate between different things. Mm-hmm. You lose the ability to have words in your mind. Your conceptions start to go during the fifth phase.
Hmm.
So all your conceptions start to dissolve. So you no longer, your mind becomes more open at that point, because it's really our conceptions that anchor us into this, the kind of lives that we've led.
Hmm.
And that at that point, in the fifth one, when the mind begins to dissolve the conceptions, you start to enter into the center channel. The upper winds of the center channel are starting to dissolve into the center channel at the top of the head. And by that time, the candle looks white. It's like white light, and it has a kind of empty quality.
Okay.
Without contents. So you're getting more and more subtle and refined as you go. And then the sixth one is the mind of white appearance. Now, they say that from our father in conception, we get a dot of white, and from my mother, a dot or nadi of red. So these are like bindus of red and white. And they both, at this point, in the sixth dissolving phase, the mind of white appearance, or the father's white dot, enters into the center channel and starts to move towards the heart center. And after that, the mother's red dot moves into the center channel and starts to move up towards the heart. So those two, the red and white, are going to meet in the heart center. And they're going to enter into the heart drop, which is the essence, our life essence, that travels from life to life to life. So this has a continuity, a continuum, and a stream of consciousness. It is our stream of consciousness, they say, resides in the heart center. Hmm. So now the conception of our father and mother's dots are moving in to become one with this life force.
So in the ending of your life, you're actually mixing the mother and father again, like you did at the initial conception, right?
Right. Hmm. And it mixes in with your own consciousness.
Hmm.
So, because that's what created us, you know, the mother and father, DNA and earth, all these elements from them have come together to create in a new, beautiful, unique form who we are. And so now that comes back together as it's going to travel to the next life.
How interesting. So this process, all of these steps, could they take like 5 minutes or 6 weeks? Is it like...
Exactly. It's unique to each person. This part up into where we are now generally goes fairly rapidly. But in a great meditator, someone who has realization, who's been meditating a long time and really has come to an understanding of the emptiness of all phenomena, this from now on can take weeks. They can sit in samadhi or lie without decaying for a long time if they realize this clear light of death, which is now coming. Because when the mind of red increase and the white both meet each other, white appearance and red increase in the heart center, then the mind becomes totally clear and empty, and you go into sort of a black swoon. So everything becomes black. It's like you've fainted away. And when you wake up again, you're in this totally clear light, unbelievably luminous, bright, vast space. And that can last for a millisecond, or it can last in a variety all the way up to weeks at that point. So an accomplished meditator could sit in the clear light of death for a very long time.
And why would he choose that, Rachel?
Because...
I'm gathering you choose it, right?
Yes, 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 you are. You're actually not only choosing it, but you're working towards that, you know, by meditating and training your mind to apprehend that state when it arrives. Because the reason it goes quick is we don't recognize it.
Ah.
Yeah, that's why, you know, it might go snap, because we've never seen it before. We don't recognize it, it just goes by. But if our mind recognizes that state as an enlightened state, the longer we sit in it, the more possibility there is for us just to remain enlightened. And that's it, where we've become a vast enlightened being.
Wow.
At that point. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we all have this opportunity at the time of death. It's so exciting.
But it's about being very conscious about it, isn't it?
Well, yes, and other people can help you. This is the other good news is, you know, your friends and family who you take with you up there to Vancouver, you know, we can help each other through this process. The more people who know about it, the more help that we can all have, the higher the vibration will be.
But when you say that we can help each other, is that through observation, through breathing, through energy, through sound? What is it?
It's through the whole thing. You know, first of all, you come with joy and peace and love and light and openness to create that environment around the person who's dying rather than wailing and worrying and angst or any of that. You know, it's the opposite of what we think normally. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you're wanting to bring the highest, lightest, most wonderful energy, thoughts, because as I said, you know, people who are dying pick up on our thought forms quite easily.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first thing, creating that environment. Then you can actually do POA for that person as they're dying, even as they their breathing starts to get slower and slower. You can start to do POA, which is a series of sounds. So it's a visualization. It's a series of sounds. You know, you can bring their favorite deity or their, you know, Jesus, whoever it is that they revere. You know, you want to fill the room with feelings of support and love, really. So whatever supports that person to feel love at the end of their life is so important.
So if you feel love, then you can extricate yourself from, well, I guess this means we should talk about the bardo, because if you're confused, I'll let you take it from here. You know where I'm going with this, if you feel a lot of confusion and so on.
Right. So then, after you've gone through the clear light of death, mm-hmm. and you've either realized it or you haven't, then, enlightened beings who actually reach enlightenment through the death process or have in this lifetime, because there are beings that do, mm-hmm. they can choose their incarnation. So when they're reincarnated, they can choose to come in a place where they feel that they could help the most, which could be a hell realm.
Ew, really?
Hmm. Yeah. And, you know, when they're in the hell realm, it looks like heaven. You know, because it's how we perceive. It's our psychological makeup that creates not only our life this time. You've seen people who live in hell here, haven't you?
Oh, I sure have, yeah.
And people who also live in heaven. Mm-hmm. It's really our own perception of what this is that creates our relationship to it and how we feel about it. So when an enlightened being goes into the hell realm to help people, it's just incredibly beneficial for everyone. And it totally changes the environment just by their being there.
So it might be like a war zone or a...
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Mm-hmm. Or the heart of a city.
the heart of a city,
yeah.
Yes. It could be any place where there's incredible trauma and strife and discord and unhappiness. Yeah, but then we go after the clear light of death into the bardos. Now, bardo is a term that means it can be, you know, bardo can just mean the continual now that's between past and future. So we're always living the bardo, unless we're stuck in the past or dreaming about the future. You know, it's that continual now, and after the clear light of death has ended. Mm-hmm. We go into an intermediate being, which is sort of a light body that can journey from one existence to another. It can go through walls. It can go through time and space. It's not anchored by the earth energy that can be much slower, you know.
So it's our spirit self? Is that it?
You could call it that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yep. And so then at that point, you go through the reverse of those things I just spoke of, those phases. Mm-hmm. You go the reverse back into the bardo being. And then, depending on your karma and your psychological makeup and the kind of thoughts that you've generated, you'll have experiences that mirror your state of being, your state of mind, what you've done in your life. So you'll sort of pass through different, could be visions, illusions, hallucinations. You know, you're going to be going through, again, this is a Tibetan idea, all these experiences that really have directly to do with your life and what's gone on in your life.
So, for example, if you've been really mean or been caught up in a lot of violence or something, you would see that mirrored back to you in the bardo?
Yes.
Hmm.
And that is if you haven't purified it, because the lucky news is no one goes to hell forever. No one goes in these dark, horrible places forever because of impermanence.
Okay.
And we have the ability to purify anything and everything that we've done. But it's a lot of work, and you have to really make the intention to start to purify your own karma.
And you can do
today
that.
Today is a good day to start. Yeah.
So we can do, let's go back to the word karma. We had a nice chat on the phone the other day, and I asked you about karma. Was it an Indian thing? And what you explained to me is, no, it's very Tibetan, right?
Well, no, karma, you know, there are two different religions. You know, in India, Hinduism really became to the fore, but there's karma. The Indian religions in general have karma as part of the philosophy, mm-hmm. but also in Tibet, karma is a big part of Tibetan Buddhism.
Hmm. And how do the Tibetans describe karma? What is it?
Well, their seeds are imprints that we've made through our actions, behaviors, thoughts, desires, repulsions, whatever we've been going through. Becomes like an imprint in our mind, like a fragrance or something that permeates our being on a very subtle level. It can be a gross level too. It can be many levels. But karma can go all the way down to just almost like a little fragrance somewhere in us.
Hmm.
And the idea is that we can purify all those levels of karma. But to purify the really subtle levels, then you need to go to a subtle level. And you need to be able to go there. Which indicates, you know, meditation practice is important because that's a major way. Of course, there's grace, there's spontaneity, there's all kinds of different ways that we can purify karma. But if you want to make sure, then it's important to really, and this is where Tibetan psychology comes in, to really make an inquiry into your mind to see what's going on. So we actually come to be aware of what we're doing in the moment that we're doing it.
So is that like paying attention to, oh, I'm feeling competitive or I'm feeling insecure?
Mm-hmm.
Or it's just feelings, is it?
Well, it's feelings, it's thoughts, feelings, apprehension, perception. In other words, you want to know as soon as possible, you know, if you're feeling competitive, that's a big kind of feeling.
Mm-hmm.
You want to know as soon as possible that that is actually what you're feeling, and you may be doing something to your best friend, say, that's not so friendly because mm-hmm. you're feeling competitive. And then if you knew you were feeling competitive, then your behavior wouldn't be a mystery to you.
Mm-hmm. And it might even change. Don't you think it might even change at a subtle level or something?
Yeah, definitely.
And would that change the karma?
Yes, it would. Mm-hmm. Totally. This is how you ameliorate karma.
Hmm.
Through awareness, through changing our behavior so that we become kinder and, you know, reach out to people, help people, and we become one world, you know, helping each other out rather than going through the kind of competitive strife that we do these days.
Or things like jealousy, competition, envy,
exactly.
and all those things which say, if you have it, I don't. So big danger, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, it's really, so when I go back to, let's go to deities, for example. You said you can bring in grace. Can you bring in, do people pray to specific beings to help alleviate their karma, for example?
Definitely. So there's Vajrasattva. Have you ever heard of Vajrasattva?
I have heard of it, but I don't quite know what it is.
Vajrasattva is the purification deity. So you pray to Vajrasattva to purify your being, and you actually do a practice where nectar runs through the crown of your head and through your body, taking away all the dark, you know, gluey, smoky things right out through you. So that, you know, if you do a Vajrasattva practice every day, you're continually purifying the negative things that we do, and we do them all the time, inadvertently, not even on purpose, really.
Mm-hmm. Is this a practice that's like a meditation, or is it like an energy flow, or is it like a prayer, energy flow, meditation?
Yes, exactly. It's E, all of the above.
Really?
So it's a visualization, a meditation practice, an energy flow, and you do the meditation practice until it becomes a living reality in your being, because we're plastic, we're fluid beings. You know, we get stuck often, but really ultimately we are so fluid and able to move and change things. And that is life. Life is constantly changing. So if we're in the flow of life, then we can actually do this, and we can bring in these powerful images and archetypes and deities and allow that energy to transform the essence of our being and run through our channels. So we have liquid light running through, like the meridians from Chinese medicine, for instance, clarifying and purifying and tonifying our whole being. And this is something we can do. I mean, it's available to anyone, really.
And the arrival of the Buddha in Tibet, and you said something very interesting recently, which was that when Buddhism arrived in Tibet, they systematized it in a very intricate way. Is that right?
Yeah, well, you know, the whole country was Buddhist, so they had a lot of experience, which they did. They really got to know this religion in depth. And, you know, so many enlightened beings existed in Tibet. And so
why would you say, was it because of the Buddhism, but was it because of the Buddha, or was that just the nature of Tibet?
I think, you know, again, it's everything, because Tibet is a, you know, very high place, not only physically, but spiritually on the planet as far as vibration goes. So a lot of very high beings, I think, were attracted to incarnate there. And so not only that, but they were so isolated from the rest of the world because of the Himalayas and being, you know, the snow and the cold and getting being so hard to get there. So they had kind of a pure place to practice where they weren't sort of inundated with the things that were going on in the rest of the world. So they really purely practiced this form. And, you know, although Tibetan Buddhism is a religion, it's also a philosophy and a deep spiritual practice that has can change the reality of the being by doing it, which is what interested me so much about it.
And how did you get into it? That's interesting to me.
When I was in college back in the 60s, I studied Buddhism. I wasn't my major because, of course, I'm a dancer. But I did take some classes in the religious studies department.
But wait a minute. And your dancing has included sacred dancing, has it not? Has been a major drive, hasn't it?
Right. But that was later. You know, I've been a professional dancer and a dance teacher most of my life. I started dancing when I was six, you know, training, actual training, ballet. And so it's been a long time that I've been dancing. So I've done lots of different dance forms. And it was when I met Lama Tarchin Rinpoche, maybe a few years after that, in the early 90s, I started to do the Lama dances at his retreat center, and then eventually ended up teaching them and doing these little performances every summer there.
And has it, let me see, the question I have, because I know you also do Qigong, I'm just going, when you're doing those dances, the deity dances you called them, do you feel the movement of energy through your own meridians, through your own channels and so on?
Right. Well, you are, the point is to emulate the deity, so you are visualizing yourself as a deity, so that you become, in that moment, you are transformed into a light being. You're wearing the costume of the deity and a mask, and you have the instruments of the deity, a little drum, bell. It varies from dance to dance. You're doing the, the movement, which is a mudra, and so So everything that you're doing is to inspire that deity to approach you and to become one with your physical body, so that you actually are feeling yourself as this light, open, powerful emptiness.
Wow.
In movement.
So you're in, would you say you move into clear, what did you call it? Clear mind, clear lands?
The clear light. Yeah. Well, one hopes, but you know, that's a big tall order, but you might feel yourself as a light being. Definitely it's a transformative experience that is not within your normal range of experience, for sure.
Wow.
And with Qigong, it's so wonderful, wild goose Qigong. You know, the wild geese, not only just the physical wild geese that are here, but also the mythical archetypal wild geese, fly to different planets in the Milky Way, and they bring back elixir to us so that we become one with the movement of the wild geese. We open our chakras and palms to receive this nectar from the wild geese. Hmm. So it's sort of a similar thing.
So, and in Tibet, do they, in the ancient tradition of Tibet, because I know a lot of beings have had to leave Tibet, right? But they're carrying the tradition along. I guess what I keep thinking is, you know, when they say that if you're, for example, a good intuitive, you've probably been an intuitive many lifetimes in order to improve. A good dancer has probably been a good dancer many lifetimes in order to embody that. I don't know if you agree with that.
Well, you know, you see some children and they're total prodigies. How did they do it? Mozart, for one.
Yeah.
You know, how did they start playing incredible music or dancing when they just come out of the womb and they're almost just dancing right away? You know, you often see that in young children, that they clearly have a relationship and connection to these forms. And I think it's so true that, you know, intuitives, we've probably had many, many lives as intuitives. And the Tibetans say just to brush by someone on a street means you've had many lifetimes where they've been your mother.
Oh, that's wonderful.
So it's sort of a limitless, you know, thing where it's it boggles the mind to think about the amount of times that we may have gone through being an intuitive or on different planetary systems. Even the Tibetans don't limit it to here. Mm-hmm. You know, they're all into other planets and beings and so on. You know,
I didn't realize that. That's wonderful.
Oh, yeah, other planetary systems to here and bring in new knowledge or knowledge that hasn't been developed here very much. So,
well, if you're having the wild geese come in with the elixir,
you
have to be pretty interested in other galactic centers and other universal downloads.
Totally.
And so on.
let's get it on. Let's bring it from other planets. Totally.
Cross fertilization. I think it's kind of interesting that the ancient Tibetan civilization was relatively, of course, now talking about galaxies, this isn't quite true, but relatively isolated. But then the Dalai Lama has had to leave home and create home everywhere he's gone, right?
Right. You know, and that, I think that's part of our development now as a one world system. And I mentioned the web last time, is that we're becoming more and more of a one world, a unity. And mm-hmm. he's been a major factor, I think, in bringing it out of Tibet and giving the world the gift of kindness. And
compassion.
Really, compassion.
He's an elixir in himself, isn't he?
He is totally an elixir himself. I mean, completely. The enlightened mind stream here on the planet is just such an amazing gift for us all to even just to see it, you know, to feel it for an instant. Once you feel it, you remember it. You know, oh, yes, I could go back there and feel that again one more time. Mm-hmm. And so it becomes a part of us. The whole earth, the whole world changes the vibration of the whole world. And one of the statements I just love from Tibetan Buddhism, and that is, anything can happen anytime and often does.
Oh my.
So there is no limitation. There is no conceptual box that you have to live in. Hmm. It's totally open-ended, beautifully.
And you also said that, like, the Tibetan psychology is a rather important evolutionary tool, is it not?
Yeah, because, you know, a lot of meditation practice is analytical, Vipassana, for instance, mm-hmm. where you're wanting to really address what is it that's going on in your mind. Because if we're just blindly going through life, our impulses and our, you know, we just get blown by our winds of karma and we don't stop it mm-hmm. because we don't see what's going on. And so a really important part of Tibetan Buddhism is really going, sitting, inquiring in your own mind, okay, you know, what did I do today? Did I do 18 black deeds and 3 white, you know, as kind of good and bad by our own judgment? Or was I kind, you know, more during the day today? Mm-hmm. And if I was, could I be kinder tomorrow? And through that kind of inquiring into what is it that we are actually doing, we can then transform our behavior to become way more beneficial, not only for ourselves, but for others. And of course, they go together. When we hurt others, we really hurt ourselves too.
We do, don't we? So it sounds yeah. very evolutionary in terms mm-hmm. of bringing in universal wisdom, bringing in the heart, bringing in compassion. But I keep going back to the image that there they steep themselves, these reincarnating souls that are working toward a higher and higher consciousness, and they got spilled all over the world. I like that. It's
yeah.
it's a wonderfully healing image, isn't it?
It's very healing. And you know, that was the gift from the Chinese going and invading Tibet. I'm being slightly facetious. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, in China, you know, it has an incredibly developed spirituality before the revolution, cultural revolution. And they had a lot of Qigong masters who are also incredible meditators, and they are doing physical meditation of Qigong. And they started doing, you know, all over the country, millions and millions of people doing Qigong. And it became this really incredible form in the hospitals. They were curing people with Qigong in actual, you know, acupuncturists doing medical Qigong in the hospitals. And then suddenly there was, because Qigong is related to spirituality, that aspect of it started to worry the government. And so they cracked down on Qigong, and so a bunch of Qigong masters came.
Oh, it came over here. Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah. So they had both sides, the Tibet side and then their own mainland of China. They've been filling the world with spiritual beings. You know, it's just sort of
in spite of
great
themselves.
And antithetical to what their purpose was.
Yeah. It's really fascinating. Now, what exactly is medical Qigong? I think I know. Is that where, for example, if you have a terminal illness, the movements of Qigong, you just keep doing that like 8 hours a day to heal? Can you tell us a bit about medical Qigong?
Right. Well, I think, you know, what you've just described is one way of doing it. Of course, medical Qigong can be done when you're healthy, too, as a preventative medicine. Mm-hmm. And it is that you practice these movements. And what the idea with medical Qigong is, it's very connected to Chinese acupuncture. Hmm. So you're trying to move energy through the meridians so there are no obstructions in the body. Because when the body becomes obstructed or stuck, or that's when disease starts to happen. So it's moving gentle, very gentle, easy moving through, almost like you're riding a fluid horse or something. Mm-hmm. It's that you get this fluidity, inner and outer movement in the body. So you're opening those channels, bringing in light, love, whatever that's needed, could be heat, could be cold, through those channels in the body. And there's so many channels in the body. There's like, I don't know, let's say 72,000
larger
channels.
Oh, my goodness.
40 million smaller.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
You know, we're just full of this incredible treasure that we so rarely use. And that is, we can infiltrate our whole body with living light. And we become a light being. We are a light being. That's what we really are. We just have to remember.
Do you think that we're, as a species, do you think we're waking up to that?
I do. Mm-hmm. I think there's so many energies now that are pouring in. It's just such an exciting time to be alive, that we can explore these energies, you know, really go into the depth of the body, because we know so much about it scientifically now. We can go into how the muscles are functioning, and then we can enlighten them with our own visualization and understanding of light in the body. I mean, it's such a special time. I am so happy to be alive now. Really.
I love that, actually. Well, we had a chat the other day that you had seen Lincoln, and you were very grateful that you weren't living in that period of time.
Oh, boy, that just seems so difficult, dark.
Yeah, and you know, stuffed up channels. Dark. And they say, too, that if somebody from 200 years ago met us today, they'd find us shimmering light already.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
I believe that. I really, you see it. You do. You see people who are shimmering light.
Yes. Now, yeah. I want to go back into the dying process. Looking through the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, I've read most of it, but not all of it. Mm-hmm. And there was a section, and I remember asking you before, if it's true that, for example, the lamas or Rinpoches, when they die, they don't get rigor mortis because they've released a lot of their old beliefs, their old structures, substructures. And then there's another story there about how one of the lamas knew, or several of them, I can't remember the detail here, except that knew he was going to pass, so he isolated himself for 7 days and released himself. Is that, you know, when you were talking about being able to elongate that process of the seven different phases of releasing consciousness, you know, when you talked about it at the beginning, where a more enlightened being might stay there and stay in that darker place for a while to choose enlightenment, is that right?
It's not a dark place, though.
Oh, okay.
It's totally illuminated. It's the clear light of death. It means totally pure, clear light.
Okay.
That you're sitting or lying down, whatever. Mm-hmm. You're having an incredible experience of the most brilliant, vast, amazing light possible.
Hmm.
So, yeah, you don't want to be interfered with at that point. You don't want anybody to touch you, move you, burn you up, or anything.
Or expect
you
anything
be allowed.
From you. Well,
yeah.
Well, I
would expect anything from please.
Yeah, leave me alone so I can concentrate here. But I was just wondering if it was the same the same process as what you were talking about earlier about enlightened people staying longer in it. Is that the
right.
same thing?
You know, they do say if you're not afraid, to die alone is the best. You know, if you really know what you're about, to go off and really die by yourself is really the... you have the best opportunity. But if you're afraid, you know, you need helpers, you should get them. You know, you should do whatever is going to work for how it is for you in that moment.
That's really interesting.
Yeah. But many enlightened beings are in caves back in Tibet. There were many special caves that were very much about meditation. And they would go to these places and die by themselves and leave nothing behind but maybe hair and nails.
I know, I just think that is outrageous. Isn't that something, hey?
But remember, anything can happen anytime and often does. Because we're magical beings. This is a magical display. It's not the reality we think it is. It has a total ability to transform and flux and move and change and... it's not as solid as we really think. Often.
And so releasing attachments and aversions, that's the classic thing, isn't it, through meditation and so on.
Yes.
Gives us the freedom. Now tell me quickly before we get to the end of all this, what about do beings talk to, we're not that close to the end, good. Beings talk to beings on the other side, meaning, let's see, when someone is looking for the reincarnation of someone who's of a high spiritual nature. That's a Tibetan system, is it not?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
they're getting less and less into that system, but it's been a very strong system for a long time.
Why are they getting less and less?
Well, I think they got worried that people who were up to not the most beneficial ideas would get a hold of the incarnates and then keep them locked away and so on. So that's gone a little more away from that. At one point, and I'm not sure what it is like now, the Dalai Lama said he was not going to reincarnate here because there was some worry that the Chinese would try to find him and hold him captive. I'm not sure that that's still the case. You know, things really change over time, and that's been a long time now. So that could be really different. But what they're looking for is signs of this young person, that they remember the mala or the mantra or something of that lama. And often the lama will say, you know, after I'm dead, go look in this province for this person and like that. I'm not so sure about the Tibetans and the ghost talking, although they have a huge path and a huge amount of deities and a huge amount of demons as well. So, you know, the demons, I don't know if they're talking to demons or what. But I do think myself, personally, that there are people who can help us from the other side to die. And, of course, in all these near-death experiences, there's often a loved one at the other end of the tunnel calling you on or sending you back. If it's near death, go back. Don't come now. Too soon.
And does the Tibetan system honor that? Do they talk about near-death experiences?
Well, you know, what they've said, and I'm not an expert on this, but they've said, well, that's near death. And it's not actually dying. So it's slightly different than actually dying and going into the bardo and having that whole full-on experience. I mean, you might go through the first couple phases of the dying process and get pulled back, so you don't have the full experience, is what I've heard about it.
And how many bardos are there? Isn't there like four or five or different levels of?
I think there's
I kind of think of them as soul repositories while you go through some learning. Is that right?
Right. Well, there's you know, they say there's different bardos within this lifetime. Actually. So there's the bardo of this life. There's the bardo of meditation where you go into different states of being than your normal state of being. So that's considered a bardo.
Oh, it is.
There's the bardo of dreaming. So when you're asleep and dreaming, that's a certain kind of bardo. And then there's the bardo of dying. And after that, there's the bardo of dharmata and existence. So there are those bardos that we continually go through here as we're living. So the sixth bardo is a bardo where you're becoming or transmigrating into your next form. So the karmic seeds or the karmic storehouse is blowing you into your next incarnation. So you come and you see your parents, whoever they are. It could be giraffes or people or whatever. And you're watching them have sex, and you're attracted to them, and you are then go right into the ovum at that point.
If you are enlightened, you don't need to do any of that, right?
Exactly. You can choose. You can be born in a lotus blossom. You know, you are now a magical being.
If you're enlightened,
power,
that is.
Yes, with the power to do, you know, to a certain degree, as you wish. Yeah.
Well, that's kind of mind-boggling, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
So it's really worth doing the conscious dying. Seems like it's really
so important. My wish is for everyone to at least have that idea that they can die consciously and it can be an amazing experience.
Now, Rachel, you're quite a meditator, aren't you?
I am, yes.
So let me ask you this. There are a lot of people who claim to go through with people who are dying and come back again. Can you do that? Have you experienced
it? Oh, no. No, I have not done that. I'm not saying I wouldn't someday be able or want to do that. But so far, you know, I want to stay here in this body, in this life, and really anchor myself so I can transform right here. Now, when I helped my parents through their death process, I did POA for them, but I didn't go with them. I wanted to release them into their own process once they went through the gate and out. And so I tried to create the best situation possible for them, and then I said farewell to to them, and I haven't tried to communicate with them even. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Although, you know, there have been times in my life where that veil has gotten lighter and I have had many visions or, you know, voices happening. But for me, I'm really wanting to teach the physical, like the dancing and the Qigong and the inquiry into the behaviors here, and really concentrate on that right now in my life.
That's wonderful.
But it's not to say the other thing isn't wonderful and amazing, and that people, I'm sure people do it all the time.
It's just all so interesting, isn't it? When you're helping your parents, for example, cross over, quite often there are connections, as you probably knew, between parents and children, right?
Mm-hmm.
Did you find yourself clearing a lot of your
mm-hmm.
own? Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Was
yeah.
that a wonderful experience for you?
It was really important. As I maybe told you last time, I think going through my parents' demise and death was the best thing I've ever done in my whole life.
Hmm.
And I took the time before they died. I did an incredible amount of work with them in each individually, and clearing of, you know, familial and historical and ancient patterns and all the karma that we had together. And not to say I succeeded 100%, but I did take time.
But they had to be participant in that, did they not?
Well, you know, my mom had strokes, so she participated to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
So that was 5 years with her and 4 years with my dad. So 9 years altogether
mm-hmm.
there.
That's a lot
this.
Of time.
It was time. You know, it wasn't the only thing I did. I did.
But tell me, and you know that in some cases people would be resistant to consciously working with that. Can you still do a fair amount?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. You know, especially on the subtle inner planes, you can do an enormous amount, especially if you're feeling loving kindness toward that person or a parent or whoever it is.
Mm-hmm.
If you're even just sitting in the space with them and feeling loving kindness towards them, it's purifying an immense amount of karma between the two of you. So it isn't even that that person has to verbally agree, oh, yes, when you were 6 years old, blah, blah. You know, it mm-hmm. doesn't have to be that.
You don't have to put everything out on the table and pick each thing apart.
No. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. You can do that. I mean, that can be valuable for certain experiences, I think.
I think there's a lot of people who are not interested in going through that, but they're maybe their
yeah.
children or parents, whoever, that might
yeah,
want
to
do
it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you don't have to. I mean, it's up to the two people involved, really.
Mm-hmm. Really.
How
yeah.
does that work? How can we communicate the best with one another to really clear up any kind of muck and, you know, bad energy and bad feelings between us before you go away forever. And, you know, the hard part is sometimes when people are about to die, they have such a hard time saying goodbye, they try to destroy that person.
Ah.
Mm-hmm. So it can be tricky.
Oh, I was going to say, a couple of times when a friend is about to die, they get mad at me, and I realize,
mm-hmm.
yeah, that's
yep.
exactly what you're saying.
Yep.
Wow,
yeah.
And so ultimately, for karmic release, for example, it is about being deeply in the attitude of love, the giving mm-hmm. of love, right?
Yes.
So that's really kind of the glue for this transformation, huh?
I think so.
Where are you teaching, Rachel?
Right now, I teach at UCSC, mm-hmm. Cabrillo College, and San Diego School for Integrative Studies. I also teach Qigong in Ocean View Park in Santa Cruz.
Wonderful.
On Fridays from noon to 1.
Oh, like outdoors.
Outdoors, because it's so wonderful outdoors.
Wow.
Qigong is just, because it's about nature. You know, it's about the elements. So to be right there in the elements is pretty wonderful.
Well, and this has been so wonderful to have this incredibly dimensional chat with you about the other side, this side, the other side, and the whole thing.
And what we can do is, you know, most importantly, you know, we have this side and that side, but what are we doing? That's what's important. That's what's so amazing. That's where all the power and the glory and the amazing treasure chest of beingness resides. Like, what are we doing?
What did you tell me the other day? And this is probably a wonderful thing to end with because it sure shifted my thinking for the last couple of days. You said when you're driving, let
Oh, yeah.
Go ahead. Explain that
because
I
ahead.
Love that. Well, it's just beautiful. You said drop any of the what the goals you have or the what the temporary ambitions. Let yourself just be. Drop everything and let yourself be.
Right.
And boy, that's
hit
me.
Yeah, if you find yourself driving down a pretty country road, you know, to drop the idea that you're going anywhere. Of course, you're going somewhere and you'll get there. But to let go of going anywhere and to feel, because you're moving in a car, so you have movement happening, fluidity. And you're just riding along in that moment without an agenda, without going anywhere, without pushing through space. The car is moving along. You can put all your baggage down. You don't have to think about any of that. You can just enjoy the moment without anything on it.
Just
being
so
present
lovely.
With it. Yeah, it's a wonderful feeling.
It made me feel being in the dance of the universe rather than doing anything, you know?
Exactly.
Thank you so much, Rachel Van Dessel.
Thank you,
you're
Veronica.
Just wonderfully enriching conversation. Thank you, thank you.
My total pleasure. I've just enjoyed you so much, and I hope to see you soon down here in Santa Cruz.
Me too. I hope so too. Thank you so much, and many blessings to all of you who are listening to Rachel Van Dessel. And boy, it's just been really transformative for me. So again, thank you. Good night. Thank you.